arguments regarding section 48-177. I respectfully submit that this is the only issue that need be addressed because this court should vacate the relevant trial order and then the other issues become moot. The primary issue boils down to this. Did the trial court have the authority to rule on appellant's withdrawn motions? I submit that 48-177 controls, and pursuant to that statute and related case law, the trial court did not have the authority to rule on the withdrawn motions. The Workers' Compensation Act allows both employees and employers to file petitions and motions. A motion can be filed with no petition on file. In other words, a motion can predate a petition. There need not be a petition on file for a party to file a motion.
But here we had a petition, or we had a complaint, and it was filed by the plaintiff, and that was Ms. Fentress, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
The employer was not the plaintiff.
Well,
maybe a movement on a motion, but was not the plaintiff.
That's a good point, Your Honor. I don't think the complaint or the I don't think the petition was operative at that time. I don't have the dates off the top of my head, but you had a petition, you had an answer, the court ruled on that petition.
Did it rule on everything in the petition?
Yes, it did, Your Honor.
Wasn't MMI still at issue? And wasn't MMI raised in the petition?
Yes, Your Honor, but it ruled on all issues that were ripe at that time.
Because but it hadn't ruled on everything in the petition.
Well, I suppose that's technically correct, Your Honor, but if the court finds, and maybe I should retract that, if the court finds that the plaintiff is not, if the court finds the worker's not at MMI, then in effect it did rule on MMI. What's the status of MMI? The court found no MMI, so it did adjudicate that issue. But to return to Your Honor's question, I believe that the status of the case at the time of the relevant motions before the court today, the petition was not operative. There had not been any litigation for quite some time. I filed the two motions. Those were the at-issue and live causes, as 48-177 calls them.
Is that really an apt comparison? I mean, the language is, cause may be dismissed without prejudice to a future action. Are cause and action motion language or case language?
And I agree, Your Honor. The statute is not the most clear. And going to the prior question, well, I think that would be an absurd reading of the statute if, due to the unique nature of work comp, where these matters can last forever, they can last for decades. You can have a petition, you can have multiple petitions after the court's ruled on the initial petition, you can have multiple motions, you can have motions before the petition, you can have motions 20 years after the petition. But reading the statute, the court is certainly correct. The statutory language does not indicate movement. It says plaintiff. But when we look at Section 1 of 48-177, it says at the time a petition or motion is filed, and then it later says the trial court shall be assigned to hear the cause. So I think when the only way to read that is cause describes petition or motion. And then looking at Section 2, it again uses the language cause. So I think cause in Section 2 has to be a petition or a motion.
How about a different framework? This was just motions. These were just motions, not a dismissal. Parties are entitled to file motions, right? And the motions were on deck. So what's the law around that under 48-162-03? Any party can file a suit or proceeding in a dispute that might be subject to a case. So why did I'm puzzled why the court went to 177 and did all these gymnastics.
As I discussed in my brief, I'm open to the reality that 48-177 might not apply in just general legal...
Well, that's what I'm suggesting as a potential alternative universe.
I'm inclined to agree with that. I think the court has two ways to vacate the order, and I think both would be appropriate. 48-177 say that my motions were a cause that could be that my client had the right to withdraw because it was represented by counsel. And I think also general judicial principles that trial courts, not just trial courts, only decide cases and controversies. Once I withdrew those motions, there was no case or controversy before the court to rule on. Courts can't go looking for issues to adjudicate, they have to be brought by litigants. And once I withdrew that, there was nothing for the court to rule on.
Well, your motion had been withdrawn, but the issue of MMI remained in the case because it was raised in the petition. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. And there was nothing to stop. Let's do a hypothetical. The trial court initially agreed with me. It doesn't rule on it. There's nothing to stop opposing counsel from quickly filing a motion. I'll represent to the court. It's very easy to get quick hearing dates, particularly with this judge.
So then how are you prejudiced by the court deciding the motion you sought to withdraw?
Well, I don't think prejudice is an issue, Your Honor. I think that's irrelevant based on the statutory language. 48177 doesn't indicate my client that any prejudice...
What if we're outside of 48177?
Well, again, I don't think prejudice is relevant. I think there was nothing before the court to rule on. I think that's it's simply irrelevant. The court can't just go ruling on issues that are not brought before it, and once there was nothing before the court to rule on, it didn't have the authority to do that. I think this is a textbook definition of a trial court acting in excess of its authority. I simply posit to the court that prejudice is irrelevant.
Why did your client attempt to withdraw the motions?
Well, I anticipated that question, Your Honor. And again, I'd say intent, motive is irrelevant. 48-1, if this court decides to rely on 48-177, there's no intent or motive test or analysis.
I don't think you're not going to answer my question?
I am, Your Honor. Why I wanted more time to conduct discovery. And when the court reviews, because of... issues that came up at trial, the court will see the surreptitious recordings. I wanted to follow up with the Dr. Aviles. The court will see the scathing opinion that Dr. Aviles wrote. Clearly, he was not happy with being secretly recorded by the appellant. And the court will see that during the hearing in October, I waffled on... the trial court offered me a continuance, and I went back and forth. Ultimately, I said no. In my thinking, whether it was... good or not, was, well, I can just withdraw them. I've got that in my back pocket. But basically, my client wanted more time to conduct discovery. Also, the court will see during the hearing, I asked, if memory serves, I asked the appellant, do you have more recordings? And I believe her testimony was yes. Well, I want to get those recordings. I want to do more discovery. I want to follow up with Dr. Aviles, maybe get another doctor's opinion. I don't recall all the areas I wanted to follow up on, but the succinct answer is to conduct more discovery.
Doesn't a practice such as this create an opportunity for abuse as soon as a hearing starts going poorly for someone, they just withdraw the motions?
It could, Your Honor. But again, I would posit that's not part of the analysis pursuant to 48177.
When is a motion submitted?
Well, I think pursuant to this court's previous decisions, what does final submission mean? Miller-Gutter case, I think it was titled, final submission means this court has defined when closing arguments are done.
Under the civil practice rules. Was Miller the workers' comp case?
It was an insurance case.
Yeah, I
believe
that's right.
So therefore, we have said we don't import all that civil procedure, right, into the workers' comp area, haven't we?
I think it
might be valuable, but whether or not it's required.
I think this court could probably hold that in this case. I think it could say, well, Miller's not applicable, but the language between the statutes at issue in Miller and in this case, they're not identical, but it's similar language. So
the hearing in front of the judge had been concluded. There was going to be later written closing arguments, and during that interval between the conclusion of the hearing and the date for the submission of closing arguments, that's when the withdrawal was attempted.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the court will see that is, I filed a pleading. I forget what I called it, but I basically objected to, because the court indicated it was going to rule, I filed an objection to preserve that for exactly this reason to come before this court.
So all of the evidence had been presented?
Correct, Your Honor.
Would you characterize the motion with respect, not the motion to withdraw, but the motion that on which the evidentiary hearing was held? Would you characterize that as a dispositive motion or not?
Yes, Your Honor. And I see that I'm out of time. May I answer?
You may.
Subsequent to the filing of my two motions, I probably don't have the timeline off the top of my head. I think shortly before the October hearing, opposing counsel filed a motion for attorney's fees. But the attorney's fees motion was not heard at the October hearing. I believe it was heard in November. But at the October hearing, that hearing resolved all issues that were before the court other than the attorney's fees issue. And I think the court could rule on the two October hearing motions without touching the attorney's fees issues. But I actually contemplated, do I file a petition? Do I file a motion to establish MMI? And whether it's relevant or not, I filed the motion because then I could select the hearing date as compared to my understanding if I filed a motion to court or if I filed a petition. I don't think it's necessarily important what it was called. If I filed a petition, if I filed a motion, the only reason I did that was so I could get a sooner hearing date than if I filed a petition.
When you filed the motions, you identified your client as a defendant. Is that right?
I believe I used the caption from the initial complaint. I believe that's correct, Your Honor. With that, I would request that the court vacate the relevant trial order. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Poole, good morning to you.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Bryn Holston Poole, and I'm here in representation of Susie Frentress, the plaintiff in this case, and the appellee and cross appellant. There's several issues up in this appeal. Appellant has raised, I believe, six different assignments of error. He focused mainly on the first assignment of error. And before I even get into that, I would urge the court to remember that this is a work comp case. There is a beneficent purpose of the act. Ms. Fentress, the plaintiff, is a real person. Today marks the fifth year anniversary of her work accident. She's now 30. And in that time, she's had to have 8 different injections, 2 hip surgeries, a compensable drug relapse. She's gotten herself clean. She's gotten herself into school. This is all in the record. The court has heard Ms. Fentress testify now 2 separate times and found her credible and has found in her favor. Despite the same, defendants again wanted to cut off benefits in this case, knowing now that there was a third surgery recommended. Ms. Fentress's benefits were stopped in July 2018, despite the fact that all the findings had been in her favor. Judge Fitzgerald, in his actual order, the January order, said, "You've done everything that I wanted you to do and everything I awarded early on. You did it." Please don't forget the human behind this case that has been dropped out throughout her 20s, and now that she's 30, still dealing with this for 5 years. It's very much our position that the trial court's order should be affirmed, with the exception that it failed to address an underpayment, which we brought up in our cross appeal, which defendants did not even argue in their brief. That's a simple scrivener's error. It was clerical, and Ms. Fentress is entitled to the underpayment and the waiting time penalty. Now, when we are talking about the 48177 issues, it makes my blood boil a little bit. You don't get to have a trial, hear all the evidence, hear what's going to get in, hear whether the court has any impressions on the case, and then change your mind and say, never mind, let's not do that. Is the court to disregard all the testimony that was brought in and the evidence that was brought in? My client is prejudiced in this matter because if the withdrawal of these motions was allowed, she had relied on that. I would have filed some sort of motion once those benefits got cut off in response, but we were relying on that trial date in order to present our position.
Assuming that 177 applies, when did final submission occur?
It occurred, you know, I have gone back and forth on this, and actually when I was reviewing it, I would say it for sure occurred at the close of testimony, but I would say it's even occurred at the beginning of the hearing. Now, plaintiff cite, or pardon, appellees cite to Millard Lumber, Kansas Bankers, and the Interiano Lopez case and as examples on when this has been submitted and whether this is allowed. None of those cases went to hearing. None of them, it was not a situation where evidence had been received, testimony had been received, and the court had the information before. This was all prior to the hearings being conducted.
In a civil context, when would final submission occur?
I believe the Millard Lumber case, or Millard Gutter case, says that it's at either upon waiving of closing summation or submission of the briefs. That's what I believe that says. It's my position that the Nebraska Work Comp Court hasn't adopted all of the civil rules, and they have vast discretion as well. Simply what they're asking for is a new trial.
So,
not allowed.
Again, my question's premised on assuming 177 applies.
Right.
What does final submission mean in the context of a workers' compensation case? Bearing in mind, the legislature wrote both statutes,
right,
the civil statute and the workers' comp statute.
I would say it was at the end of the introduction of evidence.
So
when the court has received
the
evidence.
Close of the hearing.
Close of the hearing. Oral arguments, written closing summations are not evidence. They are just that, arguments that are being presented to the court. If this were to be overturned, the courts would, at least in all my cases, we would be arguing right there on the spot, because I do not want to take the chance that my client's testimony and whatnot on someone else's motion may not come in. I mean, it was recorded by the court reporter. It could be used to impeach her at a later date.
Are there any unpublished decisions of the Workers' Compensation Court that have addressed this issue?
I did not find any.
Thank you.
Yes. It's our position that essentially what appellant is asking for is a new trial. I mean, that is specifically not allowed in 162.03. They're asking for another bite at the apple here, and that's improper.
So we've been talking about the October 22nd hearing as if it was exclusively on the motion filed by the defendants. Are you suggesting that that hearing was also on an issue that was raised in your petition?
I am, because the petition was still in effect. The petition not only, it prayed for temporary benefits and permanent benefits when they would be heard. She was not deemed to be at maximum medical improvement at the prior trial, and they were making a motion to, I believe he titled it as a motion to determine MMI or determine benefits, some language of that sort was the name of it. Well, if she's not at MMI, the issues from the lower petition are still in play. She's not at MMI. Okay, what about this future care? What type of benefits is she entitled to? And the like. If she is at MMI, then you still have the issues of what's the permanency.
The order as a result of the October 22nd hearing states that the only issue to be tried was whether or not the plaintiff had reached MMI.
That's true, but inherent
was that your understanding?
That is my understanding, but inherent within the question of is she at MMI is there are other questions inherent in that. If you're at MMI, are you then, what's your permanency?
Right.
The case
and then the order goes on to say there was no evidence with respect to permanent loss of earning power and so forth.
Right.
So
Right, so, and I did not set that forward because it was not our position that she had reached maximum medical.
That was the point of the hearing in your view, is that correct?
The point of the hearing in my view was to determine whether maximum medical improvement had been reached and what types of benefits my client was entitled to. Our position going into the hearing was that she had not reached maximum medical improvement. She, in fact, was still disabled and not getting her benefits that she had been awarded in a prior award, and she needed another surgery. The trial court found in our favor on those aspects and thus awarded the temporary benefits.
Do you think that the court's order, which is centered on 177, is the correct focus, that statute? If we're talking about the motion by the defendant.
I think it is the correct statute, and plaintiff is Ms. Ventress here. I think also what comes into play is what the appellant would be asking for is a new trial, which may also be 48-162-03, but I believe 48-177 stands. And the court did specifically state that appellant could have a continuance if they wanted, multiple times. My client is prejudiced, I can't say it enough, by the fact that this evidence all came in, her testimony came out. If we allow this type of procedure, it undercuts the whole judicial system.
I want to make sure I understand your answer to Judge Malarm's question on 48-177. You're saying it's the correct statute, but the defendant or the move-ont is not the plaintiff?
Correct.
It just doesn't apply here.
I say it is the correct statute, and my client is the plaintiff. Even though it was their motion, my client filed the petition and was a plaintiff in this case.
Plaintiff is in the words of 177?
Yes.
So that when the court says, well, for this section, that we'll call them the other thing, but
right.
Just for this, while we entertain this 177 event.
Right. She's the plaintiff in our position up and down on the 48-177. She's the only one that can dismiss this action. I'd further point out
me back to the language of 177, assuming we were in that in in 05, it was the action could be dismissed by the plaintiff, but the language was revised in 2011 to cause may be dismissed by a plaintiff or by stipulation.
May what? I have time to respond?
You may.
Specifically, it's my position that the cause is the entire case, not just the action that the motion is addressing. The cause, for example, in that Interiano-Lopez case, they said you cannot piecemeal dismiss it. He was not asking. Appellant had no ability to dismiss the entire cause. Or if you want to call it an action, they had no right to dismiss my client's rights under the statute.
So how do you respond to your opponent's argument about the meaning of the first sentence of 177?
My position would be that there was a petition already on file. So yes, there has been a motion filed subsequent, but he would not have been able to, even by word alone, call his motions a petition. He could certainly file motions under 48-180. He could have named it several different things, but nothing takes away from the fact that the petition had already been filed and it was on file, and it's my client's rights that were at stake. I'm out of time. Thank you. I appreciate the court's attention and would ask for a finding affirming the trial court's decisions below, but also reversing and remanding on the counterclaim. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day, then, is In Re Interest of Giovanni P.